from the Sky News Centre at 5. The Conservative Party leader David Cameron has accused Labour of despicable tactics in the Norwich North by-election and untruth after untruth. Labour lost the seat to a Tory landslide. Chloe Smith secured a majority of more than 7,000 votes. At 27, she's the youngest MP in the Commons. The Tory leader also criticised Gordon Brown for failing to campaign.
Where was the courage in not even coming to this by-election? Yeah. Yeah. And where is the moral compass in allowing a campaign of lies and half-truths about your opponents?
A teenage boy has been charged with trying to kill a man in a so-called honour attack. Its alleged victim is seriously ill in hospital. He was forced to swallow acid, then stabbed in East London earlier this month. Steven Gerrard says he's looking forward to concentrating on his football after being cleared of a fray. The Liverpool captain admitted hitting Marcus McGee in a bar in Southport last December. A jury at the city's Crown Court accepted his explanation it was in self-defence. He was cheered as he walked outside.
And I'd just like to say a big thank you to me legal team and to me friends and family and everyone at Liverpool Football Club for supporting me. Thank you. Cheers.
Amy Winehouse has been found not guilty of assault. She appeared at a central London magistrate's court after a dancer claimed the singer punched her in the face. Winehouse denied the charge, saying she felt intimidated and scared. At least 160 Britons are in quarantine worldwide because of swine flu. The Foreign Office says assistance is being given to people in China, Singapore, India and Egypt. Hopes that the British economy is on the road to recovery have been dashed by worse-than-expected growth figures. In the last quarter, the economy shrank by 0.8%, down 5.7% year-on-year. A couple who found a winning lottery ticket on a shop floor have had the money confiscated. Michael and Amanda Stacey from Swindon had already spent half the £30,000. The ticket's owner plans to sue operator Camelot. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio this week we have an ex-oil industry worker, also our regular old Labour political pundit and economics expert Martin Summers is here too. We'll be hearing a little about the St John's Conduit. That's a water conduit put there by the monks in the city centre, Bristol city centre that is, about 700 years ago. We'll also be reviewing some of this week's news stories, and then moving on in the second half of the show to look again at the swine flu phenomenon. But before all that, here's Marina Morris, and Marina has been investigating some of the facts behind the swine flu spin.
Yes, the swine flu H1N1 is the first pandemic or global disease of the 21st century. The last pandemic, Hong Kong flu, was about 40 years ago in 1968, which spread globally over 2 years from Hong Kong. Its biggest effect was on the elderly and killed about 1 million people worldwide. The World Health Organization statistics show that swine flu has infected at least 100,000 people in the 140 countries, although the numbers are continually increasing. The United States has the highest number, 41,000 infected and 263 deaths from a population of 300 million. In Europe, the UKs have been worst hit with nearly 10,700 cases and 31 deaths. Spain has the second highest incidence in Europe, this 1,308 cases. Eastern European countries, which are not so frequently traveled to by Westerns, have much lower statistics. For example, Russia 12 and Ukraine 1 officially. However, Russian websites are quoting highest numbers such as 126 causes. The full extent of the infection across the globe is, however, still evolving. The World Health Organization quotes 700
6 swine flu deaths worldwide. The deaths have other health problems too. 31 in the UK. The normal seasonal flu virus accounts for between 40,000 to 200,000 deaths in the European Union. Seasonal flu, which usually lasts for 8 to 10 weeks in winter months, kills about 8,000 people a year in the UK.
So, Marina, what are we doing about it? What's the British government and the National Health Service doing?
The pharmaceutical companies of Europe and North America have been producing vaccine strains for at least a month. Some are in the experimental stage, while others are approaching the need for clinical trials. The first vaccine will be ready for clinical trials in August. Britain has announced a plan to vaccinate half the population against H1N1 flu by year's end. These 30 million doses expected by the end of August, although there are production problems in producing sufficient vaccine affecting global supplies.
So who's most at risk from swine flu complications?
High-risk groups include people with long-term medical condition, those aged over 65, children under 5, and pregnant women. The earlier the antiviral are given, the more effective they are.
So, what are the actual symptoms? How do we know if we've got it?
The most people who catch swine flu can expect a mild infection from which they make a full recovery within a week. The symptoms of H1N1 flu are similar to the symptoms of regular human seasonal influenza and include fever, sore throats, headache, lack of appetite and coughing. Some people with H1N1 flu have also reported runny noses, sore throats, nausea, vomiting and diarrhea. More serious complications include eyes infections, pneumonia and severe respiratory diseases.
What officially are they saying about how we can prepare?
There are everyday actions people can take to stay healthy, such as frequent hand washing, covering your nose and mouth when you cough or sneeze, and avoiding close contact with sick people.
Okay, so if I think I have symptoms, what should I do?
You can check your symptoms on the NHS Direct website or www.direct.gov.uk/swineflu. Call your local surgery and ask to speak to your GP or ring the new swine flu helpline on 800 1513 513. Also, psychologists recommend staying positive.
Can you just give us that number again?
Or 800 1513 513.
Okay, so why is this infection potentially so dangerous, do you think?
In severe infection, the virus affects the lung, leading to the development of pneumonia, which can kill.
Okay, but can other medicines help?
Paracetamol-based cold remedies can alleviate some symptoms, as can drinking sufficient fluids and bed rest.
Okay, but what impact can swine flu have on the general population, do you think?
Most people who get this will have normal flu-like symptoms, recover and have built up antibodies in their blood that will help to keep them free of reinfection for several years. The most significant impact is if it hits an area at the same time, the hospital where most of staff are off sick at the same time syndrome. Some commentators are anticipating greatest effect in the winter months. Others are commenting that it's a great diversion from the country's economic woes.
A great diversion from the country's economic woes?
Oh yes, some commentators
are saying this. Okay, well anyway, we're going to be talking extensively in about 20 minutes, for about half an hour about swine flu. Thanks ever so much for that report, Marina. But before that, I'm joined in the studio by Ian Crane, who's an ex-oil worker, who you may have just been able to hear flicking through the newspapers in the background. Hi, Ian. Welcome to the studio.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for the invitation.
Could you just tell us a bit about yourself? In the oil industry you were, you say. What were you doing in the oil industry?
Well, I had the luxury generally of working in the headquarters environment, generally my responsibility was geographical, so that meant that I travelled throughout the area that I was responsible for. So, for example, I was one of the first civilians to go into Kuwait after the cessation of hostilities after the first Gulf War to look at the logistics of the firefighting exercise there.
So is it fair to say that you weren't really getting your hands dirty too much? You were working for the headquarters rather than actually getting the oil out of the ground?
Oh, that's absolutely true. I had the easy life. I was, what was generally referred to as the sort of pigeon. You know, the guys from headquarters used to fly in, sort of circle around, crap all over everybody, and then leave the guys in the situation to clear up the mess.
Oh, right. Okay. So it doesn't sound, sounds a little bit dodgy. But anyway, what did the business teach you? Just give us an insight into that corporate world and a world that very few people have really known.
Well, I guess fundamentally, what it taught me, going back to the experience in Kuwait, was what it taught me was that what we read in the mainstream media is not always based on fact. And although it took me a few years to sort of find the supporting evidence, but when I went into Kuwait, my expectation was that I would see exactly what had been reported in the media. But what we actually discovered was that the oil wells had in all probability been set alight by the US Special Forces. And today there is actually evidence available from retired US Special Forces personnel where they've admitted that they were part of the teams that set it alight. But, and although it took sort of a number of years for that to sort of fully register with me and then for me to extricate myself from the oil industry, it started in 1997 as a process of re-education where I took it upon myself to revisit everything I thought I knew.
So we were told at the time that this was a sort of slash and burn policy by the Kuwaiti regime themselves. And what evidence did you have that this was actually taking place, that it was people from outside, from the West, that had done this rather than the locals?
Well, first of all, Saddam and Tariq Aziz had always stated that they were not responsible for setting the wells alight. And the media actually blamed it, of course, on the retreating Iraqis. If the Kuwaitis had a hand in it, I'm not so sure, because they were the ones who ultimately paid for the cleanup exercise. I mean, that's why the Americans, I think, did it, was basically to get $7 billion flowing out of Kuwait for the reparations. But the evidence was effectively the dead Iraqi soldiers, conscripts that were lying around the wells, and because we were in there straight after the cessation of hostilities, obviously the cleanup teams hadn't got to them, and these guys looked very distinctly like they'd been defending the wells.
Okay, so that's a fantastic and interesting intro. We've now got to know you quite well about where you're coming from, Ian. We're also joined by Martin Summers to have a look at some of this week's news as well. Martin, you're here most weeks. How are you?
Not too bad. How's yourself?
Very well. And can you just give us a brief introduction for those of you that haven't heard you before? Where are your sort of politics are coming from? I know you were an aid worker, weren't you?
I was an aid worker in Eastern Europe for 10 years. I worked in Eastern Europe from 1990 to 2000. I lived in Poland for 3 years. I travelled all over Eastern Europe. I worked in Bosnia during the war. I'm a political activist. I live in Bristol.
And okay, so we're going to start having a look at some of the stories that have been in the news this week. First of all, we'll start with this, which was from the Daily Mail, and the headline is "Stabbing Deaths Up Despite a £12 million Campaign." Now, I'm starting with this one because this was in the Daily Mail this week, but it was disappeared off of the Daily Mail website for some reason, and we're being told that a whole high-profile government drive to reduce knife crime has seen an increase in the number of fatal stabbings in the worst affected inner city areas. Ian, do you want to start with your comments on what you think about this story this week?
Well, I must confess that I was a bit surprised to see it, because I'm sure it was only a couple of days ago that I read a report that that said that the Home Office is actually releasing statistics to say that knife crime was down on the basis of their efforts to get knives off the streets, etc. So this is a bit of a shock. So I could only assume that there must be a government department that needs some money.
It may also possibly be that the Daily Mail have got this wrong. Martin, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, obviously this is tragic. These are young lives being thrown away. Nobody should take this lightly. But one does have to realise that this kind of street violence is endemic around the world. I mean, there are 30,000 deaths from gunshots in Brazil every year. And as the economy collapses and stable work and stable patterns of life are destroyed and disrupted, we can expect more of this. Of course we can.
Hang on, I've got to just say, how real is that? I mean, I lived in Houston, Texas, you know, for a number of years. And if you believed what you saw on the TV screens every night, I lived in a war zone. In fact, when I moved my family over to the States, I deliberately went out and got the satellite TV set up in my house, because under the satellite rules, they weren't allowed to broadcast local news. So we were picking up the news in Houston from LA and Chicago. And it was exactly the same. It was all sort of, you know, knife crime here and firearm incidents here. And I'm sure if you live in that world, if that's your reality, then I'm sure you can sort of bring it about. But I mean, all the time I lived in Houston, I never saw the hint of the kind of crime that was being reported in the media.
Maybe you were living in a nicer part of town.
Well, that's possible, but I mean, I used to go over to the other side of the tracks, as it were, and, you know, nonetheless, I mean, for whatever reason, maybe I have a little good set of rose-coloured glasses.
OK, now we move on to a Bristol story, and this has been in the Evening Post the last couple of days, yesterday, I think, actually. It's and the headline is, Racists may have started a fire at the Bristol office. Now, this is about the offices of a newspaper which serves Bristol's Somali community. It's been much in the news the last couple of days. I spoke to Casey Maximat, who's the editor of the newspaper, a little bit earlier on today, and he's telling me that a few days before this incident, the word die, D-I-E, was actually sprayed up by somebody on his on the Somali Community Centre door, which also houses the Somali Youth Organisation at 236 Stapleton Road. Now, thankfully, their website is still up and running, but this is a major setback for this little Somali newspaper, which I believe comes out once a month, and it's in both in the Somali language and in English. And Casey has asked me to put out an appeal for new equipment so they can get the next month's edition out, which is basically what they're after. If anyone out there has one that they could possibly donate through and contact them through the Somali Voice website, a digital camera, and also they're obviously looking for a new office, because if you've seen the picture in the Bristol Evening Post, you'll see that the office has been completely burnt out, and also they're after a couple of computers just to get things going. So if anyone is listening has got something that may help this little newspaper get back on its feet again, very much appreciate it. But anyway, can we just go on to talk about the story itself? Martin, this is a bit worrying, isn't it, if we're seeing racism rearing its ugly head and taking out the Somali Voice newspaper?
Well, obviously, it's appalling. I mean, we don't know enough about the incident to be sure what the motivation is here. The police are treating it as a racist incident.
I know the police don't do that lightly, do they?
No, and it's got to be the suspicion in this case, hasn't it? The Somali community are well established here in Bristol, and I live on Stapleton Road, and I have to say that Somali people are by and large extremely law-abiding people. You don't see them causing trouble. They're very quiet, but you don't mess with them either. I mean, they come from Mogadishu. They're not to be messed around with.
Can you give us a little bit of background about Somalia? And because many of these people are there because of the conflict. Well, they're in Britain because of the conflict in Somalia.
The conflict in Somalia was worsened a couple of years ago when Ethiopia invaded at the behest of the United States. The Islamic courts regime, which was ruling in Mogadishu, had actually managed to stabilise the situation, deal with the warlords, and bring an element of stability back to Somalia. And when Ethiopia invaded a couple of years ago, we had a protest about it on Stapleton Road. The Somali community joined in enthusiastically. They were really angry about Ethiopia's invasion, because many of them would like to go back to Somalia if it was stable. But it's not being allowed to be stable. It's part of, you know, the war on terror, all the rest of it. And in fact, the situation in Somalia as we speak is appalling. Millions of people are refugees. Starvation and violence are the rule of the day. And that's all to do with Western meddling. The situation was stabilising, and now they've destabilised it again. And the Somali community are rightly very angry about that.
Can I have your thoughts then, Ian, reading through this story?
I must confess, I don't really know the Bristol area very well, so I think I'd rather pass on that, if I may.
Okay. Now we're going to move on to something a little bit more mundane, which is the massive project to electrify the West Country main line, that is from Paddington to South Wales. And we heard a couple of days ago Lord Adonis is outlining that the Bristol to London railway plans, that a £1 billion scheme where money is being spent to electrify the entire line. Now, I did hear on Radio Bristol this morning, they were saying that this is actually, once this job work is done, that it means that that it will actually be cheaper to run the trains. But I wonder whether they've considered all the maintenance of all this electrical gear that's got to run all the way along the top of the line for that 120 or so miles. What are your, is this good news, Martin, or is it or not?
I think it, you know, expenditure on transport infrastructure is kind of good news, but why haven't we done this 30 years ago? I mean, they're only deciding to do this stuff now, but we should have had an integrated transport policy to get us out of our cars, to move people around. This should all have been done years ago, and they're now bringing it forward. Well, yippee! But
we're being told that diesel fuel is very expensive and bad for climate change and that sort of thing, and that the electric is actually going to be a lot better, and it's going to mean the trains are quicker too.
Well, it's like they've had this stuff in France for years.
Okay, Ian, as someone who's from the oil industry, they're cutting out the diesel and now using electricity to run the trains. What does that mean?
Well, in terms of the fuel, it actually depends on how the electricity is generated, because in some cases you need as much or maybe even more fuel to power the generators than you do to power the trains. But I think it's got to be good for the West Country. I mean, those of us that live in the West Country, I mean, I live in the deep southwest, you know, where the average family income is around £30,000 a year. And, you know, anything that can be done to enhance the prospect of employment in the area and also enhance the accessibility. I think, you know, what we've got with the London-Bristol-South Wales line is a line that was gagging for electrification a long time ago. I mean, the line is almost dead straight in a lot of places, you know, so the 186 mile an hour possibilities are much more apparent, you know, on the southwest lines than they are on some of the other lines of the country.
With this £1 billion scheme, I mean, is this the right time to be spending money on something like this, or should it be going to propping up businesses, schools and other things which we're told are under threat?
Well, you know, that's the $64 million question. I mean, you know, $1 billion in the scheme of things is a fraction of what we've just paid to bail out failing banks.
Yeah, well, obviously, I mean, this is the kind of thing we need to be doing, but is the resource there? I mean, the budget deficit is being forced up because of the bailout of the banks. What worries me, Tony, is that the British public out there, according to opinion polls, believe that what we need to do now is cut public expenditure. Now, this is simply wrong at this stage of the cycle. We need to balance the books in the long run, and we need to do that by raising taxes on the wealthy, not by scrimping on important investments like this. And another thing which you haven't mentioned is that in the Isle of Wight, there's a wind turbine company which is going bust with a loss of 600 jobs. And at the same time, we've got a government saying we need a green industrial revolution. Meanwhile, 600 jobs making wind turbines are going down the drain. Meanwhile, we're bailing out the banks. We've got to stop bailing out the banks. That was stupid. We shouldn't have given them any money. And we need to husband our resources effectively to rebuild the economy on a sensible basis.
Now, I think you may be on your own on that, Martin, saying we shouldn't have given the banks any money, because surely the economy would be in total collapse.
No, you don't allow the banks to collapse. You prop them up, but then you take them over. What we're doing is giving private banks our money. We shouldn't be doing that. If we take them over as a bankrupt concern, we shouldn't be paying to take those banks over.
But surely what we've done is take them over as a going concern.
What we've done is we've preserved them as private banks by chucking public money at them, which is absolutely bonkers. If we're going to take them over, we should take them over. We should have a nationalised banking system. Let's get it over with. But we're not doing that either here or in the United States. The bankers are basically holding a gun to the rest of society's head and saying, give us the money. And we are giving them the money. This is absolutely bonkers. And then we've got no money to do all the other things.
But there is a government company which has been set up to manage the government's investment in the banks, hasn't there?
Yes, but it's all very hands off. It's all very much we want to get back to business as usual with private banks as soon as possible. Private banking is over. Private banking started in the Middle Ages in Northern Italy, and now that era is gone on for several hundred years, but private banking is finished.
Well, I think maybe the chairman of the Royal Bank of Scotland might beg to differ with you, Martin. Anyway, on to you, Ian. What are your thoughts on the financing of projects like this?
I have some sympathy with Martin's view, maybe not with some of the finer detail. But, I mean, the one point that I will absolutely take issue is that the fastest way to not get out of the current strife is to tax the wealthy. And the bottom line is, I mean, you've only got to go back to the creation of Italy, what was about 130 years ago. And the fledgling Italian government had no idea, really, how to raise state funds. So they called in Lorenzo, who basically gave them his report. God knows how much he charged for it. I'm sure it was a fair whack. But his report contained three words, and his advice to the fledgling Italian government was to tax the poor. And that's how you raise money. Now, I'm not advocating that for one second, but what I'm really trying to stress here is it's important to get balance, because as Margaret Thatcher found out 30 years ago, when she reduced the top-end tax rate from 60% to 40%, government tax revenues went up.
Because I'm going to dispute this.
Because a lot of people, you know, who wanted to live in the UK were actually forced out with the higher tax rates, but felt they could come back at 40%. And as you push the tax rates up, then those who have the money will do one of two things. They'll either employ somebody, often a Lebanese tax consultant, to find effective tax vehicles with which to be tax efficient, or they'll leave the country.
But as legislation increases and it's more and more difficult to employ people and more expensive to, isn't the temptation for those with the money to then just to simply shuffle that money around in various different investments to make the best return? And it's you know, they don't have to employ people then.
Well, that is true. And I mean, right now they're probably not even putting their money into the market in a lot of cases. I mean, they're actually opting for commodities.
Yeah, well, what we've got is a classic Keynesian liquidity trap where the wealthy aren't investing in the economy because it's easier for them to sit on their wealth.
Martin, what is a liquidity trap? I don't want to ever come across one. Please tell me what it is.
We're in one at the moment. The problem is that people who need stuff can't spend because they haven't got the money. So I've lost my job. I've got no spending power. But BA pilots have just voted to cut their own wages by 5%. And, of course, people need stuff. We need to be getting money to the poor so that they've got money to spend to make the economy work. The problem with the wealthy is they don't spend their money. They save it. They hoard it. And unless you make them spend it, and you can make them spend it by taking it off them and spending it. If we were at war, we wouldn't be talking like this. During the Second World War, there was a massive increase in the rate of tax on the wealthy. But they didn't leave the country because they didn't have a choice to leave the country. Now, we've got to get back to the idea of fair shares for all. I don't agree with Ian that raising taxes on the wealthy reduces the tax take. This is Arthur Laffer's idea, the laughable Laffer curve, as I call it, which is just pretended to show that if you raise taxes, you got less return. Now, this was not based on any empirical evidence whatsoever.
But it does
the Laffer
make
curve was simply a normal distribution curve drawn on a graph and saying if you put up taxes beyond 50%, you actually reduce the tax.
But it does make sense.
It's not based on empirical studies.
It does make sense to make sure the people who are the potential employers have got enough money to employ people, though, surely.
Well, it depends who the potential employers are. I mean, in Britain in 1950, more than half the economy was managed by the state. And in actual fact, people's living standards were far higher than they had been 20 years previously. We've got to get away from the idea that the wealthy are somehow doing us a favour by being wealthy. This is why we've allowed them to make mess in the stock market. The stock market should never have been deregulated. The Glass-Steagall Act in the United States, which separated investment banking and retail banking, brought in the 1930s, abolished by the Clinton administration, and that's the root of the mess we're in now. We used to know how to manage the wealthy. They were made to stay in harness and work hard. But what we've done is we've been far too indulgent with them over the last 30 years, and Margaret Thatcher was very much to do with
that.
Well,
it's all very well moaning, crying over spilt milk. What should we be doing now, then?
We need to be rebuilding the economy on the basis of a plan. P-L-A-N. A plan.
Well, that's a great idea. We definitely have to have a plan, and I'm not sure that Gordon Brown and his team of goats...
He's no idea.
Yeah, absolutely. He absolutely has no idea. I loved Malik Brown's statement, which appeared in the Times the other day, where he said he'd seen more strategy in the governments of Latin America and Southeast Asia than he experienced in his time with Gordon Brown here, which I think speaks volumes. I absolutely agree with Martin that the Glass-Steagall Act... The repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act in 1998 was absolutely instrumental. I mean, I would actually take this a stage further. I believe that one of the reasons that all the bankers have been allowed to keep their massive bonuses, their massive payments, their massive pension payouts is because they did exactly what was required. There was, in my opinion, a global strategy to crash the Western economic model. Basically, there is, in my opinion, a game plan to completely replace the fiat debt-based currency that we have today with a carbon-based economy. And this is, of course, the dream of
carbon trading,
cap and trading. Yeah. But ultimately, and obviously it's not going to happen overnight. I mean, it's taken them 10 years to actually get the seed into the ground where it's going to germinate, but it's starting to germinate. And the way in which they can accelerate the growth of this concept is by actually crashing the existing economies.
So maybe Karl Marx, Martin, wasn't right about the way that capitalism was going to hit some sort of accidental crisis, that there is some kind of orchestration here and something else is being brought along to replace it.
From the 1930s onwards, the ruling class understood that they could manage the economy. And once they understood they could manage it, they then started to manage it in their own interest. So I agree with Ian that this is not necessarily accidental. Now, this is classic insider trading. If you are crashing the economy according to an agenda that you've already prepared, then you're in a position to make a bloody packet.
Well, isn't insider trading actually a criminal offence, illegal? Well, maybe the fraud squad should check some of these people out.
A lot of this is criminal. We are now moving into what I call criminal capitalism, where building a better widget has been trumped by all of this financial, fire, insurance, real estate shenanigans. And this is absolutely ridiculous. It's the tail wagging the dog. You've got to have an industrial economy to have a speculative economy. What we're trying to do is have a speculative economy with no industrial economy, and that's disastrous.
So those of us with a little bit of savings, how do we protect our savings in this climate where capitalism is sort of failing all around us?
Well, I would have to be very careful, obviously, how I answer that, because I'm not a certified financial advisor. So I'm just going to speak from sort of personal observation here. Basically, in the short term, then you could be very lucky, you could gamble. I mean, if you look at Barclays Bank stock, for example, you could have made a serious killing if you'd invested in Barclays in March and took your...
That's easy to say after the event, isn't it? That's easy to say afterwards.
But if you're looking at the long-term safety of your investment, your savings, if you like, then it's got to be commodities. Yeah, I mean, it was said back in the 1940s that one gold coin would buy you a reasonable quality suit. Today, one gold coin will buy you a reasonable quality suit. You know, gold is trading today at about $950 an ounce. I mean, if we were still with the gold standard, which of course we effectively moved away from nearly 40 years ago, but if we were still with the gold standard, gold today would be trading at around about $20,000 an ounce. It's $950, which of course goes to show exactly how much fiat currency has been created by the removal from the gold standard.
Can I just add to this? Most people in this country and most people in the world do not have any savings. Most people are actually in debt. Yeah? So talking about what to do with our savings, I bet you most people listening to this programme haven't actually got any savings. They're actually in debt. So talking about what to do with your savings is what we need.
So what
collective
we...
action to have an economy which meets people's needs and isn't just driven by this wretched profit motive, and that's the only thing that's going on.
But this brings us actually on to one of the other news items that you got here. You know,
thanks, Ian. Moving right along,
which talks about hopes rise with the number of new mortgages highest for 16 months, and yet there's another one that says lending figures drop for a second month.
This is very confusing for people reading. I mean, they're seeing on the one hand that the lending figures are down, on the other, in the other newspaper it says they're up.
Well, so one of the things I think we've got to look at what's occurring is a lot of people, including myself, I have to say, sold their property when they
saw what was coming. I mean, I sold my property in October of 2007. I actually thought I'd missed the window of opportunity because I'd been trying to sell for about a year, but then somebody came along and took it off my hands. There are a number of people who saw the imminent housing crash. You didn't really have to be a rocket scientist to see it.
I mean, there's a very good website called House Price Crash. Yes, indeed, which they've been predicting this for a while, haven't they?
So a lot of people sold their properties at that time, and obviously, if they, well, they in probably most cases did manage to realise some capital. Many of them have actually started to go back into the market, thinking that the 20-30% reduction that has occurred in the market in that time, you know, it is sufficient for them to go back into the market. You've also got a phenomena which is very, very short term, where some parents who have available capital are actually lending or giving their children, you know, £20,000-£30,000 to give them a deposit to enable them to get a mortgage. But the reality is, we haven't seen the house price crash yet. Look, you don't have to be a rocket scientist again. Let me just give you some very, very simple mathematics here. Okay. Where I live in southwest England, the average family income is about £30,000. Okay, and in further southwest towards Cornwall, it's actually even less. In that area, a big tranche of properties are second homes, and they're in a different market because, I mean, basically, they're just not affordable to any of the local residents. But the situation where you average three-bedroom semi, which is not a second home type property, but your average three-bedroom semi has to come back down, even using an existing model, has to come back down to absolutely no more than 2.5 times the average family income in that area, which means that, you know, where I live, the average three-bedroom semi has to come back down to about 75,000, but they're still being marketed at 175,000. So there is a long, long way for the property market to go. And I think that fall is going to come in the next 12 to 18 months.
Well, it does. I mean, it does tally with the fact that the mortgage companies are very reluctant to be lending with the current market prices. Although the volumes of the numbers of mortgages going out is very high, the actual amount of money is not...
It's gone up slightly. It's like, you know, 2% of nothing is nothing. I mean, this is all whistling in the dark. We're whistling in the cemetery here. I totally agree with Ian's analysis of where the market's going to go. What we need to do is get away from the idea that we've got to buy a house to live in and have a property bubble. What we need is some decent social housing. I need decent social housing. I'm about to be kicked out of my private rented place because the guy who owns it is not paying the mortgage, and I'm going to be thrown on the street. I need decent, affordable place to live so I can go out to work.
We absolutely have to get away from the mindset that a property is an investment. It's not.
It's a place
to
live
over our heads. I don't think it matters which side of the social spectrum we perceive ourselves to be on, or which side of the political fence we perceive ourselves to be on. I mean, at the end of the day, a home should not be part of an investment package. And basically, in my opinion, sort of 30 years ago, or 40 years ago, we had the right balance. You know, coupled with which, of course, I mean, things have got out of hand with this greed is good, you know, consumerist, materialist society. Because when I look at, you know, my upbringing, my father was, you know, a lift engineer. He was your average working class Joe. And he was able to raise myself, my sister, my mother. He bought his house for £2,500 in 1953. So he was able to pay the mortgage. We were able to go on a two-week holiday every year. I don't remember a year that we missed our 2 weeks. It wasn't in Benidorm. It was normally in Clacton or wherever. But, I mean, it was 2 weeks. And my mother didn't have to work. I mean, this is a dream scenario today. It is just not possible for a young family where, you know, the breadwinner is effectively, you know, doing a working class job to be the sole earner in the family. And we have to return to that.
Okay, I'll just try and slightly justify myself in saying that this is a headline from one of the papers this week saying hopes rise with the number of new mortgages, which is the highest for 16 months. We're told a total of 35,235 new home purchase loans were granted in June, according to data from the British Bankers Association.
Even if this was happening, and it's not just an illusion, all we're talking about here is restarting the bubble. This is bonkers. We've got to get away from bubbles. We've got to stop having a bubble. We've got a bubble economy, which is from one bubble to the next, and we've just got to stop this.
Okay, anyway, we've had a very thorough discussion of the economy there, and we'll move on to our final story we're looking at this week, which is that the terror threat has been coming down, and it's now at the lowest level since the July 7th bombings in 2005. This is a report in the Evening Standard a couple of days ago. That's the official terrorist threat level downgraded to the lowest level since the London bombings. Is this good news, Martin?
I don't believe anything the government says about this. I simply don't believe it. I don't believe any level of threat that they suggest. I'm just totally cynical. In the run-up to the Iraq war, if you remember, the British Army were put into Heathrow Airport and were driving around in tanks, and the threat level was supposedly high. This was all, it transpired, part of the politics of the run-up to the Iraq war. The government wanted people to be scared. People at the airport normally have to sign a waiver which says if there's any kind of threat that they will carry on working.
Well, one of
so
the
people
things
at the airport went to the soldiers and said, well, why haven't we signed a waiver? And that's because there is no threat. We're just marching around to make it look as if there's a threat because we're going to war with Iraq. So when a government does stuff like that, spending millions of pounds to bamboozle me about something that isn't real, I don't believe anything they say afterwards.
Well, I mean, there's something here does justify in this article what you're saying there, or seems to, and that is that the threat levels always seem to jump up to a very high level just after attacks, such as the 7/7 attacks in 2005 in London, and also immediately following the attack on Glasgow Airport in 2007. Anyway, what's your thoughts on the new low terror level threat, Ian?
Well, I think the terror level threat is a complete joke anyway. I mean, let's face reality. You know, it is more that you are in putting yourself in more danger by eating a bag of peanuts than, you know, from choking on the peanut, than you are from terrorism. I mean, terrorism is a construct. I mean, we all know that in this studio. You know, whether we're looking at 9/11, whether we're looking at the London bombings, whether we're looking at Madrid, any critical analysis of the evidence shows that the official version of events does not stand up.
But it's not a construct if you're caught up in a bomb attack, is it?
That's absolutely true. I mean, obviously, the perpetrators of those events do need to be brought to justice, and that's why you guys are at the forefront of trying to get a campaign for 7/7. But, you know, one of the concerns I have is that right now there's a lot of media chatter about the shortage of equipment in Afghanistan and the justification for being in Afghanistan. And this does concern me, because if it looks as though the public support for the ongoing conflict in Afghanistan is waning, then it's not beyond the powers that be to create another construct to try and regarner the public support for the conflict. So I think right now we've got to be a bit careful.
Okay, right. So that's it for the review of this week's news. And in a moment, we'll be going on to talk to both Ian and Martin about the swine flu threat.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Right, just to remind you, we're joined by Ian Crane. Ian, you're speaking at the Glastonbury Symposium, I believe, tomorrow. Can you just tell us what the Glastonbury Symposium is?
Tony, the Glastonbury Symposium has been going for about 20 years now. It started life 20 years ago as a forum to discuss the phenomena of crop circles. But it's moved on, you know, way beyond that. And suffice to say that actually I'm sharing the platform tomorrow with Norman Baker, MP. Norman Baker is going to be talking about his campaign to get a full investigation into the death of Dr. David Kelly. So the symposium today actually covers a whole range of issues which generally don't find their way into the mainstream media.
So is it stretching a point then, do you think, because David Kelly was a microbiologist, to make any link between the swine flu and the death of Dr. David Kelly? Because he would maybe have been one of the people advising the government right now about what to do about swine flu.
He may well have been. And actually, interestingly enough, Sue Reed in the Daily Mail, I think about 2 weeks ago, wrote an excellent piece. And the headline was, Did MI5 Kill Dr. Kelly?
Now, this is quite remarkable because, obviously, a few years ago, that would have been almost journalistic suicide. But here we are, we've moved on, and now there is sufficient comfort. 13 doctors basically calling to reopen the investigation because they claim that he could absolutely not have committed suicide in the way he's alleged to have committed suicide. Norman Baker's book, of course, levels the charge of the murder at Iraqi forces expats, if you like, who had an interest in actually fomenting the conflict. But the bottom line is that we don't know the full story. The bottom line is the government has made every attempt to conceal the full story and prevent a full investigation.
Okay, well, anyway, moving on a bit more to focus down on swine flu particularly. I did a little bit of research about vaccines. I mean, this is what is being prepared, apparently, behind the scenes at the moment. And you can imagine these people sort of running around in laboratories trying to get this vaccine ready for the autumn time. And what is a vaccine? Anyway, in 1796, a chap called Edward Jenner, who's a doctor not very far from here in Berkeley in Gloucestershire in rural England, discovered that immunity to smallpox could be produced by inoculating a person with material from the cowpox lesion. Cowpox is a pox virus of the same family as smallpox, and Jenner called the material used for inoculation a vaccine, from the root word vacca, which is Latin for cow. So that's where a vaccine, or the word vaccine, actually comes from just on the banks of the River Severn, just down the road from here in Gloucestershire. We have the swine flu pandemic now, officially the World Health Organization are saying. Ian, how reliable do you think is the information coming out of the World Health Organization?
I'm very concerned. Let me just establish my credentials here. I mean, obviously, I'm not a medical doctor.
No, none of us.
But I am a researcher. I research deep geopolitics. I mean, this is the area that I look at. And so I always look at, if you like, what leads towards a particular event. And I think it's true to say that I have been of the opinion for some years that the US government in particular have been desperate to establish some kind of global pandemic. And evidence of that, I'm sure most people remember SARS. I'm sure most people remember bird flu. And back a few years ago, I was actually levelling the charge of the architect at Donald Rumsfeld, because Donald Rumsfeld, interestingly, of course, was the chief executive of a company called Gilead Pharmaceuticals from 1995 until he was appointed Secretary of State for Defense by George Bush. And Gilead Pharmaceuticals is the company that developed Tamiflu.
Now, do you know what Tamiflu actually is? I mean, it's my understanding that Tamiflu is a little bit like a antibiotic, but for vaccines. In other words, it interferes with the ability of the vaccine in your body, virus in your body to multiply.
Yeah, it's an antiviral drug, but we know also that it has extremely pernicious side effects. In the US, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, have demanded that on the packaging there is a warning that says that anybody taking a course of Tamiflu, should be monitored for unusual behavior. And we know from reports in Japan that there have been a number of deaths, particularly in teenagers, from taking the Tamiflu. So
I've got some notes here which I got off of Wikipedia, which says that the common side effects of Tamiflu are adverse effects are nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain and headache. Now, that although you see within this area, common doesn't actually mean as common as you might think. It means something like 2 or 3% of the number of people that take it. But rarely, adverse side effects can include liver disease and allergic reactions, including lung or skin collapse. So that's where your skin's just sort of simply flaking off. This Tamiflu stuff, in some cases, can actually make things worse.
No, without any shadow of doubt. I mean, what you've got to take into account is that, under normal pharmaceutical practices and approval practices, a pharmaceutical company only has to prove 5% efficacy. The other 95% of people taking it may actually not show any benefit at all, and indeed may actually suffer from serious side effects. And the pharmaceutical companies are renowned for doctoring the results of their studies.
Well, I know that there one study in Japan which said that Tamiflu was safe, that it was found that the department, that the guy who did the report, was actually funded by the Tamiflu firm. Anyway, the Tamiflu studies in Korea and Japan, it's another little bit of information that I dug out, where the drug is widely used now, they warn against prescribing it to teenagers. Indeed, for a while it was actually prohibited to allow teenagers to take it. The side effects are impaired consciousness, self-harming and hallucinations in some teenagers. And yes, Japan actually did ban it. So anyway, if someone is rather afraid to have the swine flu vaccine, are there alternatives? Is there any kind of alternative medicine that you know of that might be effective against, to maybe boost the immune system rather than try and stop the virus?
Well, absolutely. And I will speak here from, you know, my personal choice. Again, it's based on my own research. So, you know, I don't expect anybody to take anything I say at face value. But I sow seeds, and I would encourage people to look at it for themselves. And of course, with the internet, you know, we have more access than we did probably, you know, a couple of decades ago. But absolutely, I mean, it is about not just swine flu, but even the common cold. You know, we can boost our natural immunity to these illnesses by, you know, looking at the amount of vitamin C that we're taking, vitamin D in particular.
I know the high dose vitamin C, if you take it in the morning and in the evening, can actually do a lot to actually really boost up your immune system, so that whatever turns up on the doorstep, you know, however it's getting in through your nose or whatever, that you're ready and raring to fight it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I must confess, I'm not one of these people, but I mean, there are actually naturopaths who believe that you can actually, you know, keep yourself free of all illness by, you know, actually monitoring your diet, being very careful about what you actually put into your body, and then if there are any vitamin or mineral deficiencies, then obviously addressing them. And I mean, vitamin D is an important one, particularly in the winter months. And this is where I think that the swine flu thing is going to really start to get a bit scary, because, you know, there are many biologists who believe that taking Tamiflu and the mass distribution of Tamiflu is actually having a negative impact on people's immunity, on their natural immunity.
Well, many physicians will say that the idea that so many antibiotics have been used since the discovery of penicillin has actually helped some of these viruses mutate and bacteria mutate to deal, so that actually penicillin isn't quite as effective as it used to be.
Yeah, clever buggers, these bacteria, right?
Also, you have, I think you said earlier on, a little bit of information about the 1976 case of mass vaccination against a different swine flu in the US. Have you got some stuff on that?
I have, and the common denominator, it has to be said, right from the outset, is none other than one Donald Rumsfeld. Donald Rumsfeld was actually the architect behind the swine flu scam in 1976, and it actually came about because Donald Rumsfeld was a senior advisor to President Ford, and President Ford was getting nailed in the primaries by his challenger, who at the time was one George Herbert Walker Bush.
Him.
Yes. And Rumsfeld actually came up with the idea, it was a bit of a wag the dog type scam, that to get President Ford's popularity back on track, then, you know, they would have this swine flu threat. And there was some remarkable research done by a lady called Eleonora McBean back in 1977, and her book is still regarded as a seminal book on vaccination, and it's called Vaccinations Condemned. But although she wasn't aware of some of the more intricate political machinations that we are today, because obviously much of the information has been released, but she was more concerned about the use of the vaccines at that time, because her research showed actually there was only one person at Fort Dix in the US who could actually be proven to have had the swine flu. But the pharmaceutical industry persuaded President Ford to sign up for $135 million mass vaccination program, starting with the military, and then moving out into the mass population.
Well, I mean, usually with these vaccination programs, they start also with healthcare workers, don't they? They try and make sure all the healthcare workers are vaccinated.
Indeed.
Before they start, you know, dishing the stuff out to the general population.
Well, if they did that in 76, then they got lucky, because it was the military personnel that took the full brunt of the assault of the vaccines. And the reason that the 76 swine flu scare effectively disappeared under a carpet was because once they started the mass vaccination program, there were 50 US troops that basically died very, very quickly. I mean, there were five people who died basically while they was still had the needle in them. And then the others died very shortly afterwards. And in fact, within a few days, they changed the rules so that basically if somebody died more than 48 hours after having the vaccination, then it wasn't linked to the vaccination.
This is actually a little bit reminiscent of Gulf War syndrome, isn't it? Because I know one of the reasons, there were, I think, three main reasons that many of the Gulf War syndrome victims believed that they had were suffering from this. One is that because they were given antidotes to nerve agents. Another is the possible link with the use of depleted uranium ammunition, which is slightly radioactive. But the third one was that they were given a whole kind of cocktail of these vaccinations when they went out to fight the first Gulf War.
And, of course, there's been tremendous effort by the British and the Americans and every other member of the Coalition of the Willing, or whatever it was they were called, to make sure that there is no investigation into Gulf War syndrome, despite the fact that, I mean, a phenomenal percentage of personnel, forces personnel, who were involved in Gulf War I in 1990-91, are suffering from the after effects today.
I think one of the things we ought to make clear, though, is that, that the Tamiflu is not a vaccine, that the swine flu vaccine is being developed completely separately, isn't it?
The swine flu vaccine is being developed separately, and it is a real concern. And I mean, there's a couple of points that I just like to share that I pulled up recently, which people may not be aware of. I mean, in 2005, a small team from the Center for Disease Control, they used tissues from the frozen bodies of 1918 Spanish flu victims, and they dug them up in Alaska to get the genetic sequencing, and apparently it was successful. And that was in 2005. And then just 18 months ago, there was an informal, I love this word, informal, in other words, it wasn't approved, flu vaccine test, and it was carried out on 200 homeless people in Poland. Now, five died immediately, and 20 more died somewhat later. But the bottom line was that 16% of the test population were killed by the vaccine test. Now, this was so serious. The vaccine was being developed by a company called Novartis. It was so serious that actually the doctors and nurses involved in this incident were actually charged with murder. And then many people will be familiar with this. Early this year, Baxter International, from their Austrian laboratory, they released a seasonal flu vaccine, which was distributed to 18 European countries, which fortunately were never used, thanks to a lab technician in the Czech Republic, because he discovered that these vaccines were contaminated with a highly pathogenic strain of the bird flu virus. Now, this is Baxter. Now, a number of people have pointed out that actually this could in no way have happened accidentally, because of the required safeguards and tests that these vaccines have to go through before they are distributed. The Austrian Health Ministry claimed that all of the tainted vaccines were destroyed, but the World Health Organization, who did conduct an investigation, believe it or not, found no one culpable.
I think the message from all of this is that it was definitely a good idea to research some of these previous programmes and some of the news stories from many years ago. Now, we had the Marchioness of Worcester, Tracy Worcester, on the programme a couple of weeks ago, and she's an animal welfare person. She was saying that the virus, she believes, it definitely was created by the horrendous overcrowding conditions in pig farms. Is that your view, Ian, just as an amateur, a researcher?
Well, I'm actually going to bow to the experts on this one, because actually a number of virologists and scientists are actually on record as stating that the swine flu virus could not have evolved naturally. This had to have been created in a laboratory. Now, there are a number of issues here that give us some cause for concern, and many of them seem to sort of go back to Baxter. Because you got to remember that this occurred, the first outbreak occurred, just a few miles from Baxter's facility in Mexico.
It is pretty worrying, and I think there's a lots of sort of confused messages coming out of the media, of which obviously we're part. But I think one of the things that was on Newsnight last night, Simon Jenkins was talking about the government and media scare tactics, saying that swine flu could kill 65,000 people. This is the chief medical officer, Liam Donaldson. Well, Simon Jenkins was saying, well, I mean, it could kill 65,000, but it could kill none.
It could. And in fact, it's Simon Jenkins' article in today's Daily Mail. It said, this is the worst. Sorry, this is all the politics of fear at its worst. And we seem, for some reason, to be getting the benefit of the media fear campaign or government fear campaign in this country, much more so than any other country in Europe.
Yes, that's right. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it does look like almost all the cases so far, people who've died supposedly of swine flu, as the chief medical officer Liam Donaldson is saying, have actually got other complications as well going on at the same time.
Well, we've got to say that this is almost a godsend for the NHS, because now they can just relabel MRSA and C. diff. I mean, two problems which very definitely have not been resolved within our healthcare system.
So anyway, I'm going to have to stop you there, Ian, because we're coming up to 6 o'clock now. That's all we have time for this week. Join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time every week here on BCFM, where we'll be reviewing the week and picking apart some of the less well-reported news in Bristol, Britain and around the world.